Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Welcome, everyone. Good evening. Tonight, our speaker will be Brenda. Welcome, Brenda. Do you have a title for today's talk?
Yes, Applied Buddhism.
Applied Buddhism. All right. Thank you. Well, welcome, Brenda. I'm going to put you on speaker view real quick. So you can... go back to gallery view if you'd like to see everyone.
Thank you. Okay. Perfect. Hi, everybody. Let's begin. So I'd like to discuss with you a topic of some interest to me in the past few weeks and months. And that begins with the topic of the Buddhist heart. I started sort of asking myself, is there such a thing? What does it mean? How does it manifest? What is a Buddhist heart? Do we all have it? Or does Buddha have it? Is it related to the physical heart? What's going on here? What does it mean to be a bodhisattva in today's world? Now, maybe us and the ancients are really not all that different, although we often feel that we are. There's always been suffering in the world. There's always been war, starvation, disease. In fact, our generation is perhaps a little bit unusual in that we haven't had a first-person taste of a lot of this. So for us, a pandemic, you know, fires, all these issues are relatively new, but they're really not new for us as a species, as a human species. And in some conversations with people, I started thinking that maybe the toughness that some of us remember in our parents, in our grandparents, were really not pre-existing. But we're born out of some of those difficulties, the depression, world wars, all the things, nuclear scares, all the things that our predecessors had to cope with. So what is our role now? Or more specifically, because I think these sorts of things can really only be answered, at least at first, in the personal. What is my role? So, been sitting with that for a while. And one thing that came out for me was keeping our wits about us is our first goal. Paying attention as we breathe, paying attention to our minds and our spirits, practicing, trying to practice mindfully. Zen practice is a daily action, an internal and external system mingled into one. Dogen calls it an embodied practice. So even though we use Zoom, we sit, we talk, we take care of our personal lives and each other as much as we're able to. So number two, helping each other to do number one, keep our wits about us. How? By reaching out, by being available. And then number three, sort of, how do you take it further? How do the Buddhist principles apply to our American and our world predicaments? Buddha taught a life of simplicity and renunciation, of daily mindfulness practice. This may not sound very American, with our oft-frequent emphasis on material wealth, complexity, and, well, get it while you can mentality. But also in the American way is a resilience, a self-reliance, compassion and charity, among other values, innovation. Do we need new structures, methods of addressing problems, creativity, innovations? Do we need a form of applied Buddhism? How did Buddha imagine that people would be of help to one another? He provided teaching, the principles of liberation of the mind, not being caught in samsara. And by modeling the system of practice, he created a monastic intentional community. He discouraged the monks from engaging in other practices, such as healing the sick, for fear that they would become distracted and begin to focus on earning payments for their services. Instead, he encouraged them to live with each other peacefully, constructively engaged. He and the community engaged regularly in discussions and debates with the community, including community leaders on topics of how to lead life and how to live life in an enlightened manner. In our morning chant, we say, great robe of liberation, field far beyond form and emptiness, wearing the Tathagata's teachings, saving all beings. What does that mean? What does it mean to save all beings? I was talking to one of my daughters, who are my two best teachers, who said, I want to save people, but I really don't want to talk to them. Why, I asked. Because they're annoying. Saving all beings can be a big job. Saving all beings, leading people to enlightenment, no rebirth. I'm not sure what that means. What is enlightened living? One way of, maybe American way of thinking about it for people who aren't Buddhists, is the ability to experience happiness and enjoy that happiness, right? Happiness and freedom are among the American goals. Productivity, peace of mind, kindness to one another. Okay, I can buy that. Buddha changed his mind sometimes. For example, on the topic of ordaining women, he was initially very firmly against it. But he was persuaded by the insistence of his aunt and many other women who marched up to the monastery in robes and asked to be ordained. Still, he hesitated. Ananda finally asked him, is it possible for a woman to achieve enlightenment? Yes, the Buddha said. Well, then you need to ordain these women. Finally, Buddha could refute the argument no longer, and he devised a plan to ordain the women. It had many laws and stipulations, and gradually these decreased in number and scope, since it was a very new idea for the time and place. Buddha also changed his mind on the practice of medicine. When finding a monk laying unconscious in his meditation cell, covered in urine and feces, he asked his monks what was going on. You have forbidden us to practice medicine, they say. They said, well, if this was me, you would attend to me. Therefore, you must attend to him too. And slowly, he became more tolerating of the ability to possess and use medicinal substances. It began to be allowed in the community. So the monks were allowed to hang on to different remedies to help each other and their people who came to them for need. So my question for you is, what would Buddha say and do now? Or perhaps even more importantly, what will you and I do and say now? Buddha encouraged critical thinking and relying on one's experience. On his deathbed, he exhorted his monks to practice, work out your salvation with diligence. The Dalai Lama has said of Buddhism, if science and Buddhism contradict, well then Buddhism has to change. We are important part of this solving this riddle. Buddhism travels to the future through its current practitioners, us. The past informs the present. The present moves creatively into the future. Buddha was an engineer of the mind. He did not concern himself with kingdoms, social structures, but with the causes of suffering inside of us and learning to see what is there. Buddha spent a fair share of each day in collection of alms. And in this enterprise, while begging for food, he would engage in teaching of the Dharma to the outside community. The monks would also live in monasteries together. Things are a little different now. We work for our food, and our monasteries are our homes, not even our beloved Zendo. Things change. Caring for things and people, we see the suffering of the world, and we hurt. And through that process, we develop the desire to take care of things and people. We want to decrease their suffering, and if possible, to increase their peace, joy, happiness, and enlightenment. Taking care of things means paying attention to the causes and conditions of suffering and acting in such a way to allow and create the causes and conditions for well-being, peace, and happiness to flourish. That is our scope of practice, I think. In our community, we take care of each other. When we practice at the Zendo, we take care of the Zendo, even now. If the jasmine in the front is dying, we ask, why is this so? Does it not have enough water? Is there too much sun? And we work to fix the problem. We are each other the jasmine now. Previously, we have taken for granted the basic essentials of life. We need to consider of our friends and fellow practitioners. Are we getting enough nourishment? Are we getting enough water, connection? Are we getting enough meaningful work? How to take care, how to really take care? In medicine, with the advent of integrative medicine, there arose the idea of a food prescription. If someone had for diabetes, for example, they might receive a food prescription of a kale salad with pine nuts and peppers that would decrease their glycemic index. Maybe we need to think of a thought prescription for each other, such as focus on what you are grateful for today. Buddha said in following the Eightfold Path, I've always found this a bit of a mystery, even after studying it. Right thinking, right doing, right livelihood. Right for what? Well, reaching enlightenment, or increasing, in today's language, increasing joy, peace, and happiness, and enlightenment. Now, I see a few steps in this process as I try to piece it apart a little bit. One is noticing and seeing what's happening inside of us and out, without judgment, without filters, as much as possible. This is one thing that we do in Zazen. The nature of the mind is always a bit of an onion, that last part. As soon as we think that we have it figured out, and then we discover whole new layers. We're like, oh, I didn't even know this was here. Look at that. Interesting. Caring for, allowing ourselves to be moved, to flow into connection with whatever we see and feel, being one with it. And taking care of, taking care of, seeing deeply, understanding the connections, taking wise action, skillful means, diagnosis, treatment, being an engineer, solving problems. We are engineers of inner experience, of the heart and mind, and we apply the remedy, the thought, the action, or the appropriate response. And then we reassess the effects, see if what we did had any effect, and repeat the process. And lastly, we must learn how to pass it on. Buddhism has changed. It traveled from India to Tibet, China, Southeast Asia, Chan Buddhism in China went through some process of transformation, fusing with Chinese thought, Taoism, then traveled to Japan, and from there traveled here to the US. We are once again at a crossroads. Emptiness and interdependence. These are two of the key concepts in Buddhism. Through meditation, we realize that we are empty, which that is, we lack an internal, unchanging part of ourselves, but rather we are part of a complex web of interrelatedness, interwoven being. That includes not only us as practitioners, but really the whole world, the whole natural world, the whole physical world, everything, seen and unseen. How do we nurture the soil of being as both individuals and communities to bring out the best in each other? You know, one of the things I've done since being here home on Zoom a lot of the time is I took up the growing of tomatoes. And really, it started as something around March when I was bored one day. And I just threw a bunch of seeds into a little canister, a little tin from Costco, and watched them grow. Several tins, actually. I had a bunch of seeds, a package of seeds. And one of the things that happened was these things kind of sprouted. Like, I didn't even put them in little containers. They were just, I just put some soil there and I threw, I don't know, 20, 30 seeds. And then as the seedlings started growing, I took some and I put them in pots. I put some in pots. And then some, I had so many that they couldn't put them all in pots. I ran out of pots. So then I let them grow a little bit longer. And then I was feeling like I had to do something. I put them out in the backyard in what seemed like a reasonably sheltered place. So I just put them there. And, well, you might find this kind of funny, but which ones do you think grew the best? I can tell you, not the ones in the pots. The ones in the pots still have yet to make tomatoes, even though they look okay. They look healthy. The ones that I threw in the backyard that I barely cared for, just kind of watered once, maybe twice a week, have grown from instead of this little tiny plant into a huge mess, really, of it's like a jungle, really. It's the only way to describe it. That basically takes up about half of a room and it's just blooming with tomatoes left and right. Like I can't get rid of them fast enough. Anybody wants some tomatoes, let me know afterwards. I mean, are really good. the ones that were interlaced and interwoven and had to struggle and figure stuff out and figure out which way to grow, and they had this huge pot, were the ones that did the best. And it was not even a race. They were independent, interdependent. Then there were a few weeds in there too, kind of helping along. You know, God knows what grew there. So this was a great example for me of the organic nature of interdependence and how we also, as humans, probably grow best when we're in fertile soil that is interweaved with many other things. Now, go back to the Heart Sutra for a minute. You know, we often talk about the Heart Sutra as being the heart of Buddhism, and that's kind of, so in my initial quest for the heart, inevitably you come back to the Heart Sutra going, what were these guys trying to say? What's going on here? And there's some teachers that say that each one, in spite of many commentaries existing on the Heart Sutra, each person must rediscover for themselves, discover or rediscover the meaning of the Heart Sutra. At the end of the day, what is it saying? What is it saying to you? Well, I went back to the Heart Sutra, and it talks about being free of desire, being free of perceptions, being free of consciousness. Where's the heart? We don't really talk much about the heart. So what's going on here? And that when you are free of desire, something happens. There's a prajna paramita. So I thought maybe the prajna paramita is the heart. Because it's something that happens when everything else drops away, is that you come upon the heart. The heart is still there and it's still beating. Even when all our lives are falling apart, you know, what has been called a great unraveling of society as we know it, the world as we know it, our hearts are still beating. They're still here. They're still in the chest. You can see at the end of the day, at the beginning of the day, there it is. It's beating. We hope it keeps beating. And the heart is able to, when all other concepts or thoughts or desires go away, you find that the heart is able to vibrate, to resonate with the world, with this, our little beautiful beating heart. You know, in the Heart Sutra, they talk about kanji zai bo satsugyo, right? Kan, if you look at the Chinese character, I always kind of marveled at this beauty, this, how much is hidden in those little characters. But kanji zai is looking, kan, zi zai, which is in Chinese, means oneself present. The character is zi, self, zai means at. You are at there. You are here. You are zizai. And the two characters together, look, zizai means at ease or relaxing. Or as in a recent conversation came up, farting around. So you are at ease, being at ease, looking at ease, seeing at ease. You can see this interconnected nature. You can see the beauty of the tomatoes. You can vibrate at the frequency of the world, the universe. You can hear the vibration. So. You know, I strongly recommend grandparenting for any of those of you who want to feel the vibration of the world. Motherhood, you know, they say motherhood in the sutra that we just chanted, but motherhood has too many worries. You're worrying about putting food on the table. You're worried you have to go to work. You have to all these things to do. Are you teaching the kid the right thing? Grandparenting is the bomb. Or if you can't be a grandparent, you know, maybe finding like a nephew or niece or something that's available and practicing that. Good stuff. As a grandparent, you can get it. You can get it. You can vibrate with that child without really having the sense of, are they okay? Are they going to be okay? Because you're going to give them back. So we'll go back to the Bay Area a little bit. Because this is a unique area. We started out, well, it's, I guess, the American Indians. Then later, Mission Santa Clara in the 1790s, the Gold Rush. Then in the early 1900s, right, it was known as the Valley of Heart's Delight. Researched a little bit about it. It produced 99% of the nation's prunes and 70% of the world's prunes. I'll have you know. It's very productive. Actually had a blossom festival every year that ended around 1900s, and it was recently resuscitated in Saratoga in 2012. So we had our own blossom festival. Then in the 70s, became Silicon Valley, coined by Don Hoffler, a reporter in 1971. Also gave birth to the hippie movement, slightly north of here. You know, Hewlett-Packard, internet, Google, artificial intelligence, more recently bioinformatics, solar power technology focus. Not everything started here, but it blossomed here. Electric cars. These are strong, peaceful currents that have created a lot of value for our planet. It also gave rise to Haiku Zendo as part of the Suzuki Roshi's lineage, gave rise to the book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, gave rise to our beautiful Kanendo. So it has produced a lot. It is actually much more creative than maybe we give it potential, has a lot of potential that can kind of radiate out to the world. We have among us a diversity in intelligence that is unmatched. On our mornings of meditation, I am continually struck by the level of conversation that transpires. And yet, in the Bay Area, you know, our collective kids suffer high levels of anxiety and depression. Sometimes even committing suicide in our schools. Maybe one kid could be reached by a thought prescription, such as, you are not your thoughts, or you are not your grades. Your strong intellect, sometimes they don't know how to model it. They don't know how to, what it looks like to be able to get outside of their heads. So I'm proposing to you guys as a group and to the larger Zen community that we begin giving equal priority to inner and outer realities. Up to now, we have been very focused on our inner realities, really focused on sitting, meditation. And to some extent, you know, Buddha did practice sitting meditation, but he was in his society. He was also out in the world every single day. He was meeting with leaders of communities. He was creating new ideas, talking about sacrifice of bulls. How should they be sacrificing bulls? He said, no, leave the bulls be, because they don't need to kill them. That's okay. You can create peace. Just give them away. You know, let the bulls live. You don't need to sacrifice them. So he was creating social change in the midst of his teaching of meditation. And then as Buddhism got taken to China, to Japan, they were fairly difficult, you know, social systems, and Buddhism kind of became more siloed to sitting, you know, privately and in seclusion sometimes, in meditation. But so it got a little bit separated from sort of the social piece of it, which is difficult, it's messy. So that we spend, as we take care of our meditation and our Zendo, that we spend a portion of our effort as a Sangha working for and creating systems of change in our communities. Working to transform the unsatisfactory attitudes and beliefs in our society and begin to address some of the unresolved problems in our institutions. It is possible that we may need to leave our monastery and wander the paths of the world, looking for modern day alms, working creatively, using our minds to work in the service of our hearts, to work at what my daughter calls making the world a less shitty place. It's not going to get that way by chance, or by someone else, or by not even a protest, but by us quietly and with determination doing the work. The engineers, the workers, the psychologists, the nurses, the doctors, the monks, creating and finding our meaningful work and resonating together. That is really unstoppable force. What could that look like? I don't know. I don't know yet. I'm looking to all of you to help me answer some of these questions. Does it mean CSA meditation classes? Does it mean interfaith dialogue? Does it mean youth programs? Does it mean looking at the intersection of Buddhist thought with modern psychological knowledge? Does it mean modern day koans, thought meditation prescriptions? I had a few. Take less, one, some are from her beloved teacher, Les. Technology needs a partner, maybe wisdom. Thinking needs a partner, maybe city. Does capitalism need a partner? Love. Does doing need a partner? Not doing. I need a partner, you. Thank you.
Thank you, Brenda. So we're now open for questions. If anyone would like to ask a question, feel free to come to Gassho or raise your virtual hand. I want some of those tomatoes, by the way.
You
really sold
it. Got it.
I think Doug does too. Okay.
Okay. I have to organize a delivery.
Doug?
Thank you, Brenda. It's wonderful. Can you share how you actualize this in your life and how you would like us to help you?
I work in pediatric pain management. So one of the things I do is I work with the kids on this kind of stuff, you know. The kids are routinely getting into work around their pain. They have headaches, they have stomach pains, they have issues, and thinking either can help them or not help them. And so we work on finding ways out of that. We have a team of psychologists that work very hard at solving those koans that only kids can come up with. So that's one thing. One of the things that keeps kind of coming up for me is using artificial intelligence tools to work with nonprofits. You know, is that like, you know, what would the Cambridge Analytica of nonprofits look like? You know, like that. It's like you call up, you know, if everybody sends letters to A, B, and C or buys, I don't know, some product or something that could change, you know, just change the flow of things. So the directed use of our effort seems like we're unstoppable if we could figure out what to do, you know. And AI is there. It's there. You know, what does it take to change these difficult problems? You know, racism, global warming, how do we live in the world peacefully with each other? There's enough resources. It's just the use of them seems to be that needs to some fine tuning.
Sorry, Doug, I muted you because we were getting an echo, but if you had any follow-up, you could unmute yourself. Oh, Columbine.
Hey, Brenda. I had a question. You know, you said that about the tomatoes, the ones that you just kind of threw and let them do their thing. Those were the ones that did best. And so it seems to kind of contradict the idea of putting effort into trying to make things better. You know, it seems kind of like, would it be better to just, I mean, or in other words, is our efforts to try to say, make, you know, racism better or talk about it and try to, you know, help it go away, is that going to make things, is that going to stagnate things? And I mean, the ones that the tomatoes that you did the best effort with didn't grow tomatoes.
That's true. I put the winners in the you know, in the containers, and they did not do well at all. You know, yes, correct. So agreed with that. Yeah. But also at some point I looked at what was growing well and watered that patch. I figured out a way to give it, you know, daily or, you know, every few days water. So I took care of that patch. At some point I brought the sticks out and I started putting the plants on sticks so they wouldn't, you know, just, so it did require care. At some point I put a fence around it to contain the jungle. You know, so then I had to take the face down because I couldn't pick the tomatoes. So you know, the thing's complicated. But so yeah, it does require nurturing and observation and feedback.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I think that makes me feel like you're adaptive to what, like, because maybe your original plan was the ones in the pots, but you noticed that those weren't. So you changed your plan.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, for sure. We're looking at the evidence. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you weren't stubborn, you know.
Right.
You went with the flow.
I did.
Wei?
Hi, Brenda. Thank you for the talk. I enjoy it a lot. And I also learned some Chinese while listening to you. And and thank you for the tips on being grandparenting rather than being a parent. I think that's a good trick to do. Find someone so that you, a grandchild to take care of. And you mentioned something about maybe looking outside ourselves instead of focusing inside, spend some time looking at outside as well. Can you elaborate on that?
I guess, you know, this may be conversation, just setting your agenda aside and just evening, like, this is what I told my daughter who was telling me that people were annoying, which they can be, is that, you know, pay attention to that annoyance, you know, let it kind of wash over you, you know, that sort of that initial level of annoyance that you're like, are they really, like, why are they saying this? But then when you look deeper, A lot of the, you know, we share so many basic truths. We all love our children. We want to have a happy home. There's so much that is in common with us. And so focusing on the common is really important, I think, rather than seeing the difference in each other, right? And so sort of allowing that space for that other person who you find truly annoying, getting past that initial, ugh, you know, is careful. And yeah, and then really considering what they're saying, you know, and then seeing if there's maybe some truth to that, you know.
That's true.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
I think we'll all try that out while we watch the debates. Thanks.
Yeah, I was trying to think. Exactly.
Nick is next. Go ahead, Nick.
Brenda, thank you so much for your talk. I'm wondering if you might be comfortable to say a few more words about the Bodhisattva notion of salvation, especially because as Westerners, especially those of us who were born and raised in Christian households, the idea of salvation seems a little bit different from the way Buddhists discussed it. So I'm wondering if you might be willing to offer some insight on that.
I believe there's something bigger than us that we can see, you know, and maybe God is this interbeing, you know, that we are all part of, that it's alive and that it's organic, that it's growing, it's trying to find its way, and that there is a higher wisdom that we sometimes have a hard time accessing. So I do believe in that. I don't know that I believe in anybody being saved. I think that the whole saving someone else, even saving oneself, is a little, I have a hard time with that verb. You know, what does that mean? What does that mean to be saved? So it's, maybe we're continuously saving one another. You know, I maybe say helping one another. You know, we save each other through helping each other. Because when we feel alone and scared, we need someone. We need others. We need each other. And we are saved by each other. Somebody even coming to say, hey, how you doing? What's happening? Don't worry so much. It'll be okay. That person saves us from ourselves sometimes. So I think we need each other. I do think we need each other to save each other. And I think the Bodhisattva ideal was born out of this desire to reverse the tables, to kind of say, you know, it's not all about me, my enlightenment and my salvation, right? That I share some responsibility for you. It's not that I am responsible for you, but I share. There's something that we share, and there's something in the relationship that's very valuable. More to be said on that subject, I'm sure, but that's all I can think of right now.
Thank you so much, Brenda.
Diane?
Yes, Diane, thank you.
Thank you, Brenda. Whoops, am I muted?
No, you're good.
Oh, good. You might get an echo from my little speaker. Thank you for that talk. There was a lot in it. And I have to say, sometimes I kind of identify with your daughter. Sometimes I'm annoyed by people. And I think maybe that's why I get involved in doing things, you know, rather than interacting closely with people. And when I feel that way, I really then have to look at myself. It's really something in me if someone is annoying me or bothering me. So we do have to look at ourselves and know ourselves. I think before we can help somebody else, we have to know ourselves and care for ourselves, care about ourselves as well. There's so many big things in the world to think about. And sometimes it's just learning to be kind to the people we interact with every day. That's the part that's more difficult sometimes. And in our own communities, there's lots that needs to be done. And I think if we start working in little ways, and with our own family, our own acquaintances, people we run into each day, and thinking, being mindful about being kind and not judgmental, not impatient or annoyed. It's got to start there, because I can remember years ago being very involved in social justice and in war protests and the farm workers movement, you know, but was I really taking care of home? Was I really taking care of the people around me? It really has to start there. So anyway, you gave a lot of food for thought. Thank you.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Diane. I think that, you know, Les, you have taught us a lot about, you know, taking care of ourselves and taking care of the Zendo and each other. And through this model, I think that is the model, you know, of how to take care of the world as if it was a Zendo, you know? because it is a Zendo.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you all for coming tonight.
Thank you, Brenda.
This talk was brought to you by the Cannondoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to cannondoe.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.